Is it possible for my good self, James McLean, sub beta minor creeploid slaveling of the editor Christian Corley, Kington of Casterborough Castle of Creative Columns, to offer an impossibly short intro to this podcast session on the impossible astronaut? I would say up to this point, it'd be quite impossible to probulate the potentialization of that possibility. Right until now. Welcome to the sixth in the new wave of Casterborough podcasts with a K. Christian, if you would please.
Ladies and gentlemen of Casterborough, welcome to the latest podcast. Joining me is James McLean and Casterborough legend Brian Terranova. To my right, we're going to be talking about the impossible astronauts this week and a few other bits and bobs. Brian, how are you doing?
I am fantastic. How are you doing?
I'm good. And James, how are you?
I'm positively exuberant, sir.
Just for a change. So you were presumably both tuned in on Saturday in your respective locales.
Absolutely.
We saw the impossible astronaut and the shocking events unfolding at the beginning. The demands for maps, jammy dodgers and a fez in the White House. We saw, or did we? I can't quite remember. The silence. Guys, what the hell was going on?
Well, that is the question, isn't it? There's a lot of, I would assume, more timey-wimey stuff going on in this episode. I think Moffat seems to like that a bit.
Slightly.
Just a bit.
Just a tiny bit.
Right. And I don't know, personally, if this death of the Doctor is the Big Bang death that he was talking about. You know, if it is, then I kind of am a bit disappointed by it, really.
Go on, James.
I'm a bit bored by it, to be honest. I wouldn't mind it so much, but the last main series episode, didn't the Doctor die? I think he did, didn't he?
Right.
And it seems to be a lot of deaths. I know we've said this before. I found it a little smug. It's as if I've killed him off once recently, so I'm killing him off again. You guys must be really interested to see how interesting this way I'm going to bring him back will be. And I don't know, it's like, did we have to have him die again?
At the moment, from what we know of the first part, it doesn't seem entirely necessary other than some sort of elaborate way to get the rest of the companions into the plot and have that particular adventure.
Which actually, that I don't understand. Like, why did the show need to start with everybody separated?
Yeah.
It didn't make any sense to me. I mean, they were all together at the end.
Yeah, they were together at the end of the Christmas episode, and they were together at the end of the Big Bang. So, yeah, that does seem strange, and we don't know at this point. I've been wondering in my head whether or not, you know, this whole description of these two episodes as a season finale, whether they might actually be the season finale, and the rest of the season we're going to see in some form of reverse, you know, kind of out of time, Quentin Tarantino-esque.
Quite dangerous route to take because...
Yeah, that is, definitely.
Again, we were talking last week about Trial of the Time Lord and how, you know, if you throw out long arcs like that, it can be particularly dicey for viewers. And if it's quite a tense arc like that as well, I don't know, family show.
That'd be quite heavy, but there has been talk of it in being a dark one. What were you going to say there, Brian?
Well, I was going to say it was an interesting idea, like you're saying, if somehow they're kind of maybe plotting this arc in reverse. But the only thing with that is that you have to assume then that the audience is going to be there every week. And unfortunately with TV nowadays, even a show as popular as Doctor Who, there are casual viewers.
Oh yeah.
People will just tune in because, oh, this is on right now. And if you have something going backwards like that, it's going to make it difficult for them to follow. Now, do you let that get in the way of a good idea of a good story arc or not is the big question, but it could work, but it could also totally fail because somebody might be turned away from one of their first episodes because they don't follow the basic story that's being told.
Yeah. I think we need to be honest, though. We haven't got a flaming idea what it's all about. Yeah.
And part two could totally clear it up and, you know, we could be sitting here talking about how much we love it next time.
Yes.
Yeah. What do we think of the silence?
Are they definitely the silence? That's my question. Everybody's calling them that, but is that for sure? Has that been confirmed? That's what they are?
I think they're credited at the end of the episode.
I think they've been referred to in interviews.
Are they? Okay.
As the silent at the end of the episode.
I wasn't sure about whether it was silence as in silence is golden or silence as in more than one silent.
Could I just go back a sec, Brian? Just from your point of view, I mean, we're talking about the opening of the episode, having them all split up. I mean, obviously, with this season and with Torchwood, there's a bit more of a drive to the US with the show's premiere. Do you think that was to perhaps trying to establish the characters in a way which was a little more easy to consume for maybe new American viewers?
Sadly, I would have to say yes. I think moving to America was a way to try and appeal to the American audience. But as an American, and obviously I'm already, you know, in love with the show and I'm already here for every episode, but I can see it from the casual viewer's mind here in the U.S. trying to latch onto it. And I would think they might have picked sort of the wrong locale in the beginning, because when people think America, even Americans being here, where they want to go is like New York or L.A. or some big city, some big mecca, something that can completely entertain them. Not to say that we don't have our nature lovers who would like to be out in Utah and in the desert or a forest or something interesting somewhere, but to throw Utah at us, not many Americans are going to look at that and just say, oh, thank God, this is a TV show in America. You know, it's not really going to grab them in that way, in my opinion. But going to the White House, certainly, yeah, that brings it home that you're in America.
I was just also thinking the way that they had the two companions at home to establish that they were married, the fact that there was all these nuances of the Doctor traveling through time to establish that he was a time traveler, and where River's Song was. I just wondered if that was as well as much because it was being pushed towards America to sort of split it up and make it a little more easy feed for any.
You know, that's a very good point, actually. I hadn't actually thought about it that way, because you're right. They are reestablishing everything that we already basically know about the show. And since this is the first time that the show is being broadcast, well, not necessarily, but it's the first time that a series of the show is being broadcast at the same time as the UK. It does make sense that they want to quickly get more American viewers on board.
In fairness, though, I mean, if you're going to say that, I mean, I didn't notice all these aspects that you've just brought up there, James, as for in that particular sense. It's a hell of a lot more efficient way of doing it than the TV movie.
Yes.
Very true.
But then even Sylvester McCoy said in on the TV movie that he'd have preferred them not to have had him in the first episode. And then brought him in later and because it just made it too complicated.
That's right.
I still think Rose was the best approach to bringing new viewers in. It's a bit of a clunky episode compared to the rest of the show, but in actually establishing an idea. Because I must admit, if that was the intention of this episode, was to reestablish to a new audience, the TARDIS got a bit of a downplay, because I don't remember the police box appearing until it literally appears in the Oval Office. There was no setup to the TARDIS being police box before that. Did I miss a scene? Was I looking at my
phone? No, you're right.
I don't think there was. No.
Which could confuse people. So maybe it wasn't that. Maybe it was just trying to freshen things up. And I don't know. But then again,
there's always, it doesn't just have to be Americans that it's being reintroduced or introduced or refreshed to. For instance, you know, there's new kids every year. Yeah, I saw this article online that basically said that the majority of Doctor Who merchandise is aimed at 5 and upwards year olds. Whereas the majority of the audience is kind of getting older,
right,
and has started off a lot older than 5, you know.
Well, now,
this wasn't specifically about the TV show, but it did get me thinking. You've got this whole refreshing that we were talking about a few moments ago. So perhaps this is something that they want to play with every season, is just refresh who the Doctor is, what the show's about in the first few minutes of the first episode, so that you're a reasonably intelligent 5-year-old, because you obviously intelligence rates have increased in young children since Terence Dix's day, understand what's going on.
It could also be a double whammy. I mean, they could be, we need to explain this to America, but it's also going to explain it to anybody who's new to the show. So it works as a double favor for them, essentially.
Yeah, yeah. But what about the silence, though, in terms of an actual, as a threat that you forget about after you've turned away from it?
That definitely is nice and freaky to me, actually. I like that idea.
James?
It's one of Moffat's strong... It's one of his strong points is that he does do some nice and original villains or creatures. Not really, he doesn't really do villains, does he? He's not a sort of like a Holmes. He doesn't like doing Robert Holmes. He doesn't like sort of doing specific individuals.
He hasn't got any Morgus Greels or Masters, has he?
Indeed. It's more forces, elemental forces or feelings, a very fairy tale. And I thought it was a very good, very strong creature to bring into the show. I was very impressed with that.
What I like about them is the fact that there are aliens that appear from what we know from the trailers for Day of the Moon, that have infiltrated the Earth's government or the US government. They have bases apparently in some kind of tunnel network under the earth, they've got a whole Men in Black thing going on. And it, so it taps into so many different conspiracy theories. Mm. I think it's fantastic.
And there's two main things that I liked about them. First of all, was their overall look, because you're going to America. And I know this isn't just an American thing, but it's the basis of a lot of our science fiction. But you have that classic alien look that, like, in real life, the people that truly believe they're abducted actually believe that they see. You know, they've played with it a little bit to make it their own, but they generally went for that classic look.
Yeah.
The other aspect that I like is the fact that since you can so easily forget them, there's the potential that as a running arc, they could be in every episode this season and not make a gigantic impact in the episodes. They could just be there doing something in the background so that you get more pieces to the story while the main characters don't actually pay attention to them because they forget them as soon as they see them.
Mm.
There's that beauty of what you said, which I not really considered, is obviously you can take that retrospectively as well and say they were in the lodger. In the because obviously we saw the lodger console or whatever you want to call it again.
Absolutely.
They could have been in. You could even take it as far back as you want as how relevant they could have been to absolutely everything. They could be anywhere if they can do that to anyone, Time Lord or otherwise.
It depends. Yeah. Well, we don't know if they
we
can
don't
do
know
that
yet.
Yet, do we? Because he hasn't encountered them. So yeah. Anything else stand out then?
I thought Matt Smith stood out very well. I thought he looked a little different this season. He looked a little more pasty, perhaps a little thinner, a little bit of a haircut as well. But I thought his play as the Doctor was full of energy and a slight amount of threat, which wasn't there last series, really. When he's in the console room and he's quizzing them and he quizzes River Song and he really does sort of go right to the bone on it. And that's not something we've really seen much of. And I liked that. I thought that just gave him a bit more depth that he was lacking a little last season. He was a little Dr. Light last season. And that was good. I liked that.
Yeah, I agree with that. Because the one scene when they were in the TARDIS again and the Doctor tells them never play games with him, don't ever think they're capable of playing games with him, that to me was stuff that he normally reserves for talking to the main villains.
Yeah.
And to see him throw it at the companions, I mean, that was very dark and I thought very strong.
Yes.
That and when our Doctor, if you will, appeared in the diner scene and he saw the companions and the joy on his face as he just points at them all. There's no dialogue there, nothing. He just points and he's just so excited to see them. I mean, that to me was a true Doctor moment too. Those two moments together, I mean, that is classic Doctor to me.
And I love the little bit. It's just a tiny moment, which, and again, I just think it just shows how good Matt Smith is. When he does that lovely line, which they were using on all the trailers about the fact he wants 15 jammy dodgers and a Fez, and they come back and they say, we'll get you your map. And his reaction is the reaction shot. You can just see that slight disappointment. He genuinely hoped that there was going to be a Fez involved or jammy dodgers.
Very Troughton, right? Very Troughton in that respect. Like when he didn't get his recorder in the Three Doctors, you know?
Yes. Beautifully played. Absolutely beautifully played.
Absolutely agreed. Yeah. That, and I thought Rory was actually a bit standout this year. He didn't quite seem like he was so bumbling or terrified. Like he would, when the Doctor asked him to go down, he was like, no, I would really rather not go down there. And then he was like, thanks for doing it. And then he did it. And he bravely did it. He went forward. He was just like, okay, this is what I'm doing. He's developing kind of slowly, kind of like what we should have seen with Mickey. Like, not that I don't think that Mickey did grow, but they kind of threw it at you a little too quickly, where with Rory, they're developing it properly, I think.
Well, he's had 2,000 years to do that. I think he maybe would have gone down a little bit before that.
That's true, but how much of that does he remember and live by? Because if he did have that 2,000 years and he did bravely face the Dalek and whatever else came along in that story, but in this story, if he had that 2,000 years and he would have faced Romans, he would have faced anyone, really, he would have just been like, okay, I'll follow River. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
How much of that really influences his character, I wonder.
There's a big question here, which I think is reserved for another podcast entirely, on how males and females are written. And I, to put it very bluntly, I do feel that sometimes that there's a need to overcompensate with female characters to justify against how badly females have been written over the past 30 years. And this has still been going on. I think Buffy was one that really sort of pushed women into the foreground. And I find what I like about Rory is because he's not exaggerated like so many female characters tend to be these days, he's very believable from a human perspective. And that point that you just mentioned about him not wanting to go down the hole really resonated with me because he's got no weapons, he's got no shields, he's got no regeneration, he's got nothing. And strangely enough, he doesn't want to go down a dark hole in an alien-infested warehouse. And you just feel that the female characters tend to be written a little more, that there'll be a sassy comment, a nod to the audience, and then they'll go and do it. And probably the Doctor will probably be saying, don't go down the hole, and they'll go and do it. Because the female characters, after years of being so badly written on television, are given a little more guts, a little more gung-ho, and perhaps a little less realism from a human perspective. And I like Rory because he doesn't have that, because I don't think writers feel that pressure to have to overcompensate with all the crap that women have had on television for so long. And that just makes him seem a little more human. But that's why I like
it. I personally don't buy into a lot of what you've just said in terms of women being treated badly on television, because if anyone who's ever watched Coronation Street since it started would know that that's absolute bollocks.
Well, I mean, that's different.
Well, I think you have to put it in relation to what they're playing. Like in these type of shows, these action hero roles and so on, the women were generally the screamers and had to stand behind the man and so on. And we've known that for companions for years as they've tried to develop them, as we got stronger companions such as Sarah Jane and Ace. So I can see what James is saying for sure.
Yeah, I can see what you're saying as well. What I just wanted to say is that I think you're overgeneralizing there.
That's true. I did overgeneralize. That is a fair point. I was in my head is what Brian was saying. I'm talking about the action roles, and not just in Doctor Who. I mean, we're talking in film as well. You know, the woman hides behind the man, has to be saved by the hero.
Yeah.
Especially in the 80s.
That's the whole sort of action.
That's what I was talking about. But yes, you're quite right. I mean, there's a lot of shows, you know, for the last 40 years, which have done fantastic depictions.
I would just like to say, though, you two have only just met and Brian's already in your head.
Well, I'm glad he is, because, I mean, I'm glad both of you are. I'm glad that you were there to correct me and to clarify, and I'm glad Brian was there to help explain what I was trying to say better than I could.
Yeah.
Can have fun with Amy being a bit more crazy if you've got someone there who can be a little more human. I don't know.
She wasn't that crazy this week, though.
No, she wasn't. True.
Well, she's got that new secret now. You know, she's got something to protect now, so can't be quite as crazy. And I wonder how that's going to play across the rest of the season, if she's not going to jump in and do the things that she used to do in order to protect her child.
Yes, that's true. That's interesting.
Mm. Because they said that the Doctor and Amy's relationship was going to change forever. Now, we had assumed it was due to the death or so on, but they did say it was the big secret. And if she really is pregnant, if that's the true secret, then, you know, both of them are going to be a little bit more overprotective, especially if Rory doesn't know the secret.
Yeah, can't argue with that. It's just one of those things we'll have to wait for and see how it pans out. There were a couple of good guest actors in this week's Doctor Who, possibly three, depends on how you look at it. We obviously had Canton Everett Delaware III, as played by the extremely not American Mark Shepherd. His father, William Morgan Shepherd, as the older version of Canton, etc., and Stuart Milligan as Tricky Dicky Nixon.
I have a point here that I wanted to make. I brought this up after I watched the first episode, and I don't know how you guys feel, considering this is probably going to be an American point of view. Mark Shepherd and his father, I thought they were both really good in the story, and they both played great American characters, okay? But you bring the production team to America, you use American locales, and you want to have that American feel to kind of sell it to America. You put it on BBC America, you plaster billboards everywhere across the US, and then you hire British actors to play American roles, which we do in a lot of our shows, such as House with Hugh Laurie, for example. Now, not that I'm against it, because I think that's what actors do, and I think it's perfect. But I think as Americans, I wonder how a lot of the American audience are going to go, because, you know, sadly here, a lot of people will watch a TV show because they're like, oh, I know that actor. I want to tune in and see that actor. And I wonder why they didn't maybe go for a local actor that was maybe a bit more well-known.
I understood it, and I may be absolutely wrong. And if I am wrong,
I'll be correcting you. Don't worry.
James will correct me, or you guys out there can email or Twitter and find and put me right. I just got the impression that they cast him because he was a well-known name in genre TV, and he knew Doctor Who, and he could do an American accent, and he's a good actor.
Well, I would say that Mark Shepherd is actually known better in America than he is in Britain. He's known for American roles rather than UK roles.
Yeah,
so maybe that's an interesting point. I suppose from their point of view, it might have been simply that they've got someone who is as Christian says, is very much in the eye of the genre, of that sort of genre both in the sense of thriller as much as sci-fi, and is known in America for those things. And I don't think he's probably known much at all over here. I can't think of much.
No, I think the only stuff he appears in over... He was in something a few years ago that I can recall, but I can't think what it was now. But he just pops up in CSI and Battlestar Galactica and Supernatural. And
does beg a question, though, like bringing the show to America. When the show reappeared in England, it captured the eyes of all, for the most part. You know, it broke genres. It didn't just stick with sci-fi fans. It went after drama fans as well, and it became a number one show on the BBC. Breaking into America, you get this, and I don't want to downplay the actor, because he is a very good actor, but he's essentially a niche actor. You know, he's in sci-fi. He's in sci-fi related movies and TV shows here. So people who would know him would be the people who would be into this realm.
Honestly.
Yeah.
Are they trying to break into the sci-fi horror kind of genre realm here in America as a window, or do they think it's the only realm to actually break in? Whereas in England, they kind of just went across the board.
Ah, well, no, that's interesting, because I saw another link on the internet the other day, which I do have, but I can't recall where I left it. Basically postulates whether or not Doctor Who is the new Lost.
Oh, really?
Yeah. In terms of people, you know, talking about it the day after, everyone's sort of like, trying to watch it as soon as the episodes come out, and there's a bit of a timey-wimey thing going on. I said timey-wimey. Shoot me.
Do you mean in America or in general?
It was an American article.
Okay.
But I can't recall whether or not the actual author was speaking specifically about the USA or in general.
Well, I'll tell you what's great about it. Talking about trying to get the episode the next day. I mean, not only is it airing here the same day now, so we don't have to wait. We only have to wait a couple hours.
Unless you don't have to America.
And I'm sure that the American fans that used to troll the internet looking on YouTube and wherever else they could try and find it only have to wait a few hours now. But the beauty of it is if you do miss it the day of, the cool thing is here, and I assume it's probably the same way in England, is on iTunes, it's available the very next day to rent for like 99 cents. So they're really making it extremely easy for people to catch up and follow it. And maybe that has something to do with what you were talking about with the running arc. You know, this way they can get everybody to watch every episode.
Can I throw in an idea here? Because talking about this, I've always thought one of the problems Doctor Who always had in America, and again, Brian, please correct me if I'm wrong on this, is that as far as science fiction goes, over here, as we talked about earlier, the demographic for Doctor Who, while it's a family show, as Russell T. Davies used to say, there was always a very primary focus on the young audience when making Doctor Who. And I never got the impression in the US science fiction really had such a family orientated niche per se in its demographics. If that is true, and correct me if I'm wrong, does that mean that this season could be a little more adult, so it could become like another Lost, so it could appeal perhaps to a more adult American demographic?
Yeah, I would definitely say you're onto something there, because sci-fi has always been a very cult thing here. Doctor Who for years was on our public TV stations, which they're TV shows you actually have to seek out, you know, yourself. They're not heavily advertised. You go watch them because you flip the channel one day and it caught your eye type thing. It's not that like you've heard word of mouth about it type thing. The first science fiction show, with the exception of Star Trek, to actually become very well known, but to actually break the barrier of just being in the sci-fi realm, was The X-Files. So that show kind of broke ground in the same way that Doctor Who did in the UK. It spanned everybody, and everyone tuned into this show because it had something for all ages. So that could very well be what they're trying to do, because it definitely does have a more adult feel to it. It was definitely a darker, scarier, and less colorful episode that just aired, and they could totally be trying to gain the audience of Lost, that technically, if you want to use bad pun, are Lost right now because they're trying to find a new show.
Ooh, interesting. I think we've covered the episode now, so before we move on to anything else, I just want to, this is not something Brian will be able to comment on directly. James, I don't know if you were watching anything before Doctor Who started on Saturday night.
No, I wasn't. I almost missed Doctor Who.
You almost missed Doctor Who.
Blimey. I'm like that.
I actually made a special effort to come home from my sister-in-law's barbecue and housewarming party in order to watch Doctor Who. There's obviously a reason for that, ladies and gentlemen. I am sad, and I do run the website that you're listening to, so I kind of have to.
But primarily you're sad.
Primarily I'm sad. After Doctor Who, there was the So You Think You Can Dance, Dance-a-thon competition for dancey types. That's got a variety of dancey types taking part, trying to find out if they're going to be the person who gets voted the So You Think You Can Dance dancer. Now, before Doctor Who was a program called Don't Scare the Hare. This was a new game show. Yeah, this is a new game show, which I think was around 30 minutes long. I came into it halfway through and had difficulty believing my eyes. I thought I'd been hit on the head and was having some sort of hallucination. Basically, you have two teams of three people. They have to go through some games, and if they scare the hare during this game, this kind of robo-sapien-esque hare comes to life, scoots around the studio, presumably remote-controlled, unless it's some sort of homunculus, and there's some sort of disco music and these kind of really bad zoomy close-ups into the hare and then away again, like a bad music video. And it's all hosted by Jason Bradbury from The Gadget Show, doing his best impersonation of brains from Thunderbirds. And it's absolutely horrific. It makes Total Wipeout look like Mastermind. But this show got under 2 million viewers. Then Doctor Who comes on at 6 o'clock. Doctor Who averages up to 7 million. Its average was 6.5 million or so, according to the overnight figures. And then for the Dance-a-thon thing, the audience goes back to just under 4 million. So I think in terms of the audience share of Doctor Who, although there's been some reports in the press that it didn't get very good figures, nothing got very good figures. Doctor Who got a 36% audience share based on the overnights. The stuff that the BBC is scheduling either side of Doctor Who, BBC, do something about this. This is not quality Saturday night entertainment. This is not a quality family-oriented schedule. This is pandering to the lowest common denominator with Doctor Who in the middle as a tent pole, and you really need to be sorting this out.
They've had a run of that. I mean, one was, what was it, the other year, that Hole in the Wall thing.
But Bring on the Wall, of the Wall, or whatever it was called, it had Dale Winton on it, didn't it? And it had that catchphrase, Bring on the Wall! And you know, it was like Harry Hill had tried to play up to it, and he'd enjoy it a bit, and then you'd have the comparison of the Dale Winton version and the Anton Dubek version, and Brian hasn't got a clue what we're talking about.
No, I was just going to say, I know Deal or No Deal, and I got to be honest and say, it's not exactly the best show in the world, but I can understand how Deal or No Deal would make it as an international show, because it's just a nice theme where people can win money.
Yeah.
You're talking about a TV show, if I understand right, where someone dressed as a wall runs at you.
Wile E. Coyote shape in this wall that comes towards contestants who are standing on a plinth in water, and they've got to make the shape of that Wile E. Coyote hole so they can fit through it as the wall goes past. If they they hilariously fall into the water.
I personally can't understand why anyone wants to see a robot hare running away from a giant game board. It's, you know, this Don't Scare the Hare was absolute tosh.
Networks and channels have always worked out very quickly that even a cheap, crappy show may be cheap and crappy, but it can roughly garner not totally dissimilar viewing figures relative to the amount of money spent on it.
Yeah.
And so they go for it.
Prime example, and you guys might take this harshly, I guess, but it's Doctor Who. Look at the amount of money that they gave them to use, and look what they did with it, and look how many people are still attracted to it today. I don't mean the new series, obviously, I mean the classic series.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, looking at the production value, certainly as, I guess, as an American and watching it on PBS, most people would look at the show and think this is a kid's show based on how the sets were done and the costuming and so on. Whereas someone like myself would look at it and be enchanted by the idea of the show. So if the idea of something is good enough, and I've said this for years, if the idea of something is attractive enough to someone, it's going to do well. It will draw them in. It doesn't matter what kind of money you spend on it. It's attractive, and I would want to watch it. For Doctor Who, it was always the characters and the main premise of the show that always drug me in.
No, that's a fair point. I think at the end of the day, it depends on whether the idea is a good idea or whether it's just some cynical exercise in spending, you know, taking up 30 minutes of TV before Doctor Who airs.
And you can get away with putting pretty much any old crap, and if it's cheap, you're saving money. And I don't know.
Well,
it's terrible.
That's the point. I'm sorry, James, but that's the point, too. You have a new show. You don't know if it's going to do well. Put it on before an extremely popular show because you know people are going to tune in early and they're going to catch some of it.
Oh, absolutely. I don't disagree with it. Mm. Did perhaps just moving on a little, because obviously Sarah Jane on CBBC had a little show, 15 minutes, wasn't it, or so?
Yeah.
Did you watch that, Christian? I'm sure you did.
By the time people hear this, I will have seen it.
Right.
However, I'm still a little bit upset about it.
Oh, okay.
And I haven't actually brought myself to watch it yet.
I actually, due to the wonder of the internet, got to watch it myself. And I was touched by it. I thought it was really nice. However, I have to say, where was Tom Baker?
Sorry, he did do a very nice article on his website.
On his website, yeah, that was really
very touching nice. One.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well, that's good. Nick Briggs did as well on the Big Finish site. I really liked his. I'll nice. Tell you what, when I watched it, I still felt like I can't believe I'm watching this type of feeling.
I can't believe every time I open Casterbus, which obviously happens quite a few times every day, and I look at the front page, and I have a quick scan through, and I see the obituary section, and I see the words Elizabeth Sladen. I can't quite believe that they are there.
Statistically, I was just thinking it's kind of shocking that era in the 70s has been I've got to be careful how I say this because I can make it sound really crass, has had a lot of loss. If you think of Terror of the Zygons now, you've lost the Brigadier, you've lost Ian Marter, and now we've lost Elizabeth Sladen. And there's quite a few people still going, given it's such a long show. And it's just a shame that small period has lost so many people, that late Pertwee, early Tom Baker period.
My favorite TARDIS team for years was Tom, Harry, and Sarah. So
yeah,
when I found out as a Doctor Who fan getting into the show years later that Harry, this guy that I was really into, had passed away so young, I thought that was extremely sad. And I mean, I still feel Sarah Jane, Liz Sladen, absolutely passed away extremely young. And it just seems like that era, what is going on? I agree with you. Like they were so young. It just doesn't make any sense to me. It's so sad.
And I think on that note, that's a good time to end this week's podcast with a K. So thank you very much to Brian Terranova for joining us from across the Atlantic. We've transcended the time zones today to bring him to you. And thanks again to James for his excellent handling of the podcast this week. And we, or a version of we in some sort of weird collective consciousness, will return next week with a new podcast with a K from Casterbus. Thank you. Bye-bye.